Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
So the winner is the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
First of all, I'd like to thank Satan.
Anthony Kiedis burned through life like gasoline on fire.
I mean, it crossed my mind to be a singer early on when I used to sing with my mom, and then I gave that up for the idea of being a dope fiend.
Addiction, chaos, platinum records, and millions of fans screaming his name.
I love being in this band. I love these guys.
Have you been on heroin?
During the last year, I am sad to say that I have used this this narcotic substance, which you previously mentioned in this interview, yes.
But behind the MTV interviews and magazine covers was a man falling apart, locked in a messy, brutal fight against himself.
I don't think it's any secret that Anthony experimented with drugs in the past. He would go missing for weeks.
This is the story of Anthony Kiedis. Anthony Kiedis came into the world on November 1st, 1962, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. His mom, Peggy, held it together. His dad, John, was a broke actor chasing scraps in Hollywood under the moniker Blackie Dammit. The marriage collapsed by the time Anthony was four, and that left him with mom in the Midwest. But every summer, Anthony hopped on a plane to stay with dad. To a kid from the Midwest, Hollywood was like another planet. Sun, palm trees, and endless freedom. Those Hollywood visits were the happiest, most carefree times I'd ever experienced, Kiedis later wrote in his autobiography.
I think it was a great thing for him, the way that he grew up. He got the traditional Midwestern upbringing. All no-nonsense, that kind of stuff. And out with me, a wild maniac who wasn't afraid to take him anywhere, do anything.
By 1974, Anthony was 12, and he left Michigan for good. He moved permanently to Hollywood to live with his father, who wasn't the steady suburban type. He was colorful, unpredictable, and lived life like one long party.
And your dad, I guess, was a ladies' man, a drug taker, all that kind of stuff. So he was out most nights.
Yeah, he was out every night.
Believe it or not, Cher once babysat Anthony. It sounds like a random rumor, but it's true. He was literally being tucked into bed by one of the biggest pop stars on the planet.
So your dad, at least responsibly, said, hey, let's have someone watch the kid.
It was actually Sonny and this girl, Connie, that were in charge of me for the weekend. And they went out and they said, Cher, could you watch Tony while we go out?
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what does Cher do when she watches you? I mean, do you play games? Do you?
We talked.
You talked?
Yeah, she was cool. I mean, she was a good hang.
How old was she at the time?
Hard to say. Young.
20s.
Young, yeah, yeah.
Was at the height of her beauty.
She was sweet and comforting and loving and kind. And
you smoke weed with her?
No. Would have, but didn't. Sonny was very anti. There would be no weed in that house.
Back to dad. He wasn't exactly tossing baseballs in the yard. Instead, he did a lot of drugs, often right in front of his child.
He knew that I was doing drugs because everybody was doing drugs in the circles that I lived in. And I had parties at my house constantly with you know, movie stars and big rock stars and sports stars, and people weren't embarrassed to be doing drugs at that time. It was just acceptable.
Before long, Anthony wasn't just watching. He began using right alongside his dad.
We were best friends. We were father and son. We were partners in crime. We were the perfect couple and very much in love with each other.
I mean, your father was a drug dealer and sort of got you into that scene, but you don't look back and say, well, this really screwed me up or anything.
No, I think it just accelerated my sense of well-being in a very roundabout way.
I started smoking weed and loved it, and it was a very fun...
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
And at the time, subversive thing to be a part of. Like today, it's pretty damn common. But then it was very outlaw as a young teenage boy.
The fact that I shared that with my father early in life is a bit twisted. And I wouldn't do it with my kid. But, you know, from his perspective, he was sharing with me what he had discovered to be a great way of life. You know, I don't think he realized how profoundly, deadly drug use could be for certain people.
My dad beat the hell out of me. I did anything wrong, bam. I couldn't do anything, go anywhere, say anything. When I was a kid, before I ever grew up, I was determined that when I had a child, that I would never treat him like my dad treated me. So basically, I just let him do anything he wanted. He was always exposed to debauchery and drugs and beautiful women and all the stuff that I really liked.
But it went beyond drugs. His father exposed him to Hollywood's nightlife, famous faces, wild parties, and situations far too grown up for a child.
So I wanted Anthony to be able to enjoy sex from an early age. So when I had so many girlfriends, most of them were young, and when he was whatever he was, 12 or 13 or something, these girls weren't that much older than he was because I dated such young girls. So this girl, Kimberly, she agreed, and they had sex. And he was quite young, younger than you would expect a kid to be. I knew that I wanted him to be able to be the first guy in his class instead of the last, like I was.
At an age when most kids were just riding their bikes around the block, Anthony's outlook on life was being shaped by his father's world of Hollywood parties and excess.
It did make him a big hit at school. It was, what, you had sex? I'm not going to have sex for like 6 more years, you lucky guy. That's just the way I treated Anthony.
Despite the chaos of his upbringing, Anthony did surprisingly well. He earned straight A's in school and even picked up small acting gigs.
Jimmy?
What?
Can you tell me why there's a cock on top of a weather vane?
Well, because if you used a pussy, the wind would blow right through it.
And in his head, the dream was clear. He wanted to be just like Dad, an actor who partied hard and kept the drugs flowing. At Los Angeles' Fairfax High, he met bassist Flea, and the two immediately clicked.
So you met him in high school?
Yeah.
And it was like instant attraction, essentially? I mean,
yeah.
I see my opposite number.
Yeah, we fell in love, you know. I met him when I was 15, and... we had both just started the 10th grade at Fairfax High School in Hollywood. And we were like almost immediately like in love and at war. You know what I mean? It's like this.
Has it stayed that way ever
and
since?
And it stayed that way ever since. And and became my family. I mean, we were inseparable for many years, like especially when we were young. It was like every single day we were together.
They weren't just buddies. They were soulmates.
From the very beginning, I remember my mom, you know, rest in peace, who told me a few years before she died, she said, you know, I remember when you came home, you were 15. And it's hard because I get... She said to me, she's like, Michael, you came home and you were all lit up. And you said, Mom, I finally found someone I can talk to. And I really did, you know. And, you know, like any really close brotherly relationship, it's, you know, we go at each other too. But I was there. I found someone I could communicate with in a way and in a profound way that I hadn't had before.
When Anthony was 15, he also saw future bandmate Hillel Slovak play guitar live with his group Anthem. Watching that performance sparked something primordial in him and helped him realize he wanted to be part of a band himself.
Seeing how Hillel Slovak was one of the biggest influences that this band ever had and one of the most important creative elements.
It crossed my mind to be a singer early on when I used to sing with my mom listening to the AM radio. And then I gave that up for the idea of being an actor, and then I gave that up for the idea of being a dope fiend, and then I came...
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam. A charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
Back to music.
I love to write poetry and dance and just emote.
My father had kind of inserted enough art into my childhood with music and visual arts and just ideas that I was built of this stuff. I was built of words and sound.
Then came the game changer. Anthony saw Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five live. The energy, the rhymes, the crowd, it blew his brain wide open. So by 1983, Anthony had roped Flea, Slovak, and drummer Jack Irons into a band. And because subtlety wasn't their thing, they slapped on a ridiculous name. Tony Flo, and the miraculously majestic Masters of Mayhem.
He had gone to see Grandmaster Flash in the Furious Five, and he was blown away. And he was like, man, these guys are so exciting. And they, you know, they tell these stories poetically, rhythmically over funk grooves. And we were so into funk. And I was like, let's do it. You know, and he sat down and wrote this song, and I came up with a bass line, and it was a song out in L.A., and bam, we had one song, and we played a show like 3 days later. And from the first second we played, it just exploded.
They only had one song, but when they played a strip club in Hollywood, the crowd went nuts.
It was too much fun.
Hi! This is where the very first Red Hot Chili Peppers show happened way, way back in there. I think it was February, or might not have been February, it might have been March, but it was one of those early months in 1983. And we're all living together in this apartment up on Moulton and Franklin, this teeny little apartment. There are five of us in there. And we got this show. We had one song that we never rehearsed, and we just played it. We just sang it to each other. It was a song. It's on our first record. It's called Out in L.A. And I just had this part, and I just sang to all the guys. I just went.
And the club owner, we played one song in a club. And Solomon Burke, this French guy who had started a club in Hollywood, charged the bandstand and said, will you boys come back next week? Maybe play two songs. We're like, we'll see you next week.
So they added more songs, eventually rebranded as the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and never looked back.
I feel like I started late, relatively speaking.
Relatively.
Yeah. So,
but you've been performing since you were how old?
83, which would put me at 21.
It's pretty young.
But my friends had been studying and playing and practicing music since they were 10. The guys that I hooked up with musically.
Mm.
So 21 is kind of like, you already have to have started music. Let's, like with a sport. If you start at 21, it's kind of late in the game.
That's true.
These early shows were pure anarchy and chaos. Sometimes the band even played almost entirely naked, except for socks on their genitals.
Our live concerts, we wear socks on our cocks and balls. Just because we want to, and just because it feels good, and it looks good, and it sounds good. And,
it's
wet. It's sweaty. It's after we've played a gig already that we've put them on our cocks and balls, so it's a bit sweaty, really.
It all seemed like fun at first, but that goofy band Anthony pulled together was on the edge of something huge.
Tell me something. I did hear that you guys started off as a goof. I mean, you weren't really a band at first.
Well, we started off as a goof, and we decided that, you know, if we started off as a goof and we kept really working hard together, we could get even more goofy. So we've been working on that.
And it'll probably start paying off, right?
Yes.
Right?
Right. Furthermore, did you ever notice these chest hairs? That's a bad set of chest hairs. That's a very bad set of chest hairs.
Looking back now to the band's early days, it's almost crazy to think that they were able to get signed. But they did, and released their first album in August 1984.
Called the Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's going to be the wildest, craziest, zaniest, movingest, groovingest thing you ever heard.
It's an explosion of color and sound. It'll boggle your mind and bedouble your booty.
It wasn't really an album, more like a grab bag. Early songs, a couple covers, and random leftovers slapped together. On top of that, Hillel Slovak and Jack Irons bailed to tour with another band, leaving Anthony and Flea scrambling to find replacements just to keep things moving. To fill the gaps, they brought in guitarist Jack Sherman and drummer Cliff Martinez. But then came a creative clash. The producer for this album was Andy Gill, best known for his post-punk background. He pushed for a cleaner, more structured sound, but the band resisted, wanting to keep their raw, funky edge and goofy attitude. Anthony Kiedis later said they were often at odds and that Gill dismissed some of the tracks as shit. Once the album was out, two tracks carried the whole thing: True Men Don't Kill Coyotes and Get Up and Jump. This doesn't mean they were masterpieces, of course, just scrappy, funky punk jams that hinted at what the Chili Peppers would later evolve into. Still, the album flopped so hard that the band fired Andy Gill and brought in funk legend George Clinton to help them reshape their sound.
Just picked up the phone book, looked up George Clinton, called you up, and said, George, we've got $25,000 to blow.
And that's all you had to say. 25 to blow, that's all you had to
say.
We
convinced him that if we could work with him.
Not long after, Jack Sherman was kicked out when Hillel Slovak decided to come back to the band. The shuffle worked in their favor. By August 1985, they dropped Freaky Styly, their funkiest album ever. Freaky Styly was a mixed bag. Sure, there were bangers like Jungle Man, American Ghost Dance, their cover of If You Want Me to Stay, and the weird but fun Yertle the Turtle. But Clinton smothered the thing in horns and studio polish. Great if you're high with headphones, but a nightmare when the band tried to recreate that sound live. In 1987, the Chili Peppers dropped their third album, The Uplift Mofo Party Plan. Jack Irons had rejoined, bringing the original lineup back together. However, this period was marred by intense drug abuse. Flea, Slovak, and Kiedis were now shooting heroin together at rehearsals, and the lifestyle began to strain the band's chemistry.
Have you been on heroin?
When?
During the last year.
During the last year, I am sad to say that I have used this this narcotic substance, which you previously mentioned in this interview, yes.
The situation was so bleak that Rick Rubin refused to work with them back then.
I was basically a junkie, but still showing up to work from time to time, which was the basement of the EMI studios on Sunset Boulevard. They gave us a little basement to rehearse in. But we were going nowhere very slowly. Couldn't get out of our own way. But we were still making a buzz. There was still something exciting about us that caught people's attention. And it caught Rick Rubin's attention. And he was with the Beastie Boys. And they were exploding with success and greatness, writing incredible music. And so Rick brought the Beastie Boys to our dingy little recording or rehearsal spot. And he sat there and we rehearsed while they watched. They're in these little dirty couches watching us. And we went through our songs. And Rick stood up and said, "We're going to go now." And I was like, "Okay, do we talk again? What's going on?" "We'll get back to you." Didn't see him for years. Years and years and years went by. Eventually, I got clean and he came back and said, "Let's make a record." But I said, "What happened that day? You came and we played and you disappeared and I never talked to you again." He's like, "I thought somebody was going to get murdered in that rehearsal space. I thought somebody was going to die. I had to leave." That's how dark we had become. That's how dark I had become, is he was afraid someone was going to die and it was time to leave.
You know, when I use drugs, my life kind of falls apart and gets really uncomfortable and sad, and I start hurting myself and everyone around me.
People around Kiedis were basically waiting for the phone call saying he was dead. That's how far the needle had dragged him down.
He was, you know, really, really bad shape. You know, it was life and death. And this was after they signed their contracts and they finally had money, when he was actually could afford all these drugs. He would just go off on binges and, you know, be gone for weeks, and the accountants would have to cut off his credit cards and things, and then he would just be roaming the streets and sleeping in alleys and stuff like that. So yes, it got terrible, because all the women in my life have been transitional and ephemeral. You fall in love and you fall out of love. You never fall out of love with yourself. And obviously I never will. And I'm sure he feels the same way. You want to hand me the Kleenex? It's right behind you. Just hand me a couple of those, will you? And I would, like, give him lectures and try and explain to him. But, of course, you know, I can see why he would say, "Well, you're a fine one to talk. You know, you did a lot of drugs. Now it's my turn to do a lot of drugs." But as far as Anthony, I'd say he came about as close as possible as he could to dying.
Here's the twist. Out of all the drug haze and chaos came a damn good record. The Uplift Mofo Party plan wasn't perfect, but it glowed with primitive energy and steered them closer to that sweet spot between rock riffs and funk grooves. Strip it down and it's just four kids jamming their asses off, not giving a single shit about critics or charts. But in June 1988, tragedy struck. Slovak was found dead of a heroin overdose. The loss devastated the band. Irons, who struggled with depression, admitted himself for psychiatric treatment. Kiedis instead tried to process his grief in isolation and responded by retreating further into heroin, ultimately disappearing in Mexico for 5 weeks.
It wasn't really so much losing a guitar player as it was a very beloved friend, somebody that we'll never be able to replace, you know, and it's only a memory of him really now, you know, that lives on, and obviously his creative spirit in the band and whatnot, but it was very meaningless to the band. It was very meaningful to our lives. I mean, he was our friend before he was our guitar player.
You'd think watching your best friend die would snap you straight. Instead, Kiedis doubled down on abusing and kept chasing the high until eventually the drugs turned useless.
My best friend died, which did not instigate sobriety.
Did he die from drugs?
He did. But it definitely destroyed me emotionally. But I continued to use after he died. And then I got to the point where I could not turn off the noise with drugs and alcohol. Literally flooding my body with the substance and still wide awake. So I was not getting the desired effect. I was like, this is terrible. Like, I'm putting all this poison in me and I'm still here. And I called up a friend, and rehabs were not a thing at that time. I called up a sober friend and I was like, what are those rehab things? I got to find one. He's like, the only one I know of is very expensive, 10 grand, which in the 80s for a struggling musician was a lot. I was like, I have 10 grand. That's exactly how much money I have. And I spent it. I gave my last 10 grand, my only 10 grand ever, to a rehab. And I went and I checked in, and there was 30 dope fiends in the room of all walks of life, but all with a common sickness. And the counselor said, I'm looking at 30 of you, and stats-wise, one of you is going to get sober out of here.
Wow.
And I was like, get out the way, because I'm taking that spot.
By 1989, Kiedis was sober, energized, and ready to create again.
My creativity was dying when I was using drugs. It was sapping all of my creativity because, well, for a lot of reasons, but basically what I'm trying to say is I became much more creative when I stopped, and I'm continuing to become more so all the time, the longer I'm clean.
All of the negative stuff, the destructive stuff, yeah. The evil dark clouds of things, I try not to go there.
Are you glad that there are things you've left behind?
Probably the only things that I regret are losing certain irreplaceable friendships with people that have died along the way. That's something that I just can't really say that I accept entirely.
To carry the band forward, they invited a friend of Slovak to join the band, 18-year-old John Frusciante, whose talent on guitar would soon evolve the Chili Peppers sound. By the way, side note, through the years, Frusciante looked like 10 different people.
When I joined the band, I couldn't believe that they like wanted to be this other thing than they were, you know? Like, they didn't think, like, I thought of them as huge stars, you know? But to them, they weren't famous yet, you know, and they hadn't made it yet, and they wanted to be as big as Aerosmith or whatever, you know? And I couldn't, like, that was a shock, yeah.
John Frusciante, his great-grandfather, immigrant from Italy, master musician. His father, Juilliard pianist. So from the time he's a kid, this music, like, let's see what you got. And then his psychosis and way of dealing with the world was, I'm just going to sit and play for 10 hours a day.
A little later, Chad Smith also joined the band on drums.
Chad walked in, and when he walked in, he had a Metallica shirt on, and he had his hair was all frizzy. We were like, oh my God, let's just get this guy out of here.
One of the greatest drummers to ever walk the earth today. He's a phenom. But he was a little stoner living in the suburbs of Michigan who all he wanted to do was listen to music and be a part of music. But he was also a natural-born athlete. He was so coordinated. Pick up a golf club, boom. Go on the ice, play hockey, boom. He was just genetically coordinated. And then he played in 20 different rock bands as a kid, just honing and woodshedding and figuring it out until we met him when he was like in his 20s and hired him.
With Frusciante and Smith now in the band, the sound just jumped up. And the band sounded both much louder and much groovier at the same time.
We actually got very, very lucky with the two new people that we found, because they fit in beautifully. And
We just started rocking extra hard with him from the very first day. And if you guys want to walk over here right now, it's really great to have
Ringo Starr and Joe Satriani.
Ringo Starr, Yngwie Malmsteen.
Oh, this is right.
This is little Yngwie Jr., really. He's he's the unknown.
Yngwie.
He's kind of a chartered cousin of Yngwie.
In 1989, the band released Mother's Milk. While it only reached number 52 on the Billboard charts, their energetic cover of Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground gained traction on MTV and gave them wider exposure. For Kiedis, though, the moment was complicated. He was still adjusting to sobriety and briefly relapsed during the recording sessions. Around the same time, he also ended his relationship with actress Ione Skye, admitting his mind wasn't in the right place. In her own memoir, released in March 2025, Skye wrote that she was only 16 when they started dating, while he was 24, and also revealed that at 17, she became pregnant and chose to have an abortion.
And then when I met him, I don't know, I never really fell in love, but I got very ensnarled in, he's very interesting. I loved him and cared about him. And before I knew it, we were dating and we were living together. And I was just sort of, I don't know why, I thought I was curious about him and that group. It seemed so interesting, but scary. And then before I knew it, I was kind of over my head and kind of hiding out, you know, because when, you know, people are in that situation as drug addicts, they hide. So I just was sort of like embarrassed and hiding him in a weird way. And then my life got a bit small, but luckily I was doing like Say Anything. And when I would be working, I would feel vibrant, good when I was around my friends. So thankfully, the contrast of like, wait, when I'm with Anthony in our apartment and watching him, you know, be crazy and leave and come back, and I'd feel terrible. And when I'm here with my friends working and stuff, I feel like normal and myself. So thankfully that I
get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
Extra value meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Snapped out of that relationship, but it was really awful, to be honest. I mean, I love him and I'm, you know, happy. I think he's doing well. We don't really see each other a lot, but there's some love there still because he really made like big amends, proper amends to me.
Then came 1991, the breakthrough year. With producer Rick Rubin now on board, the band moved into a mansion said to have once belonged to Houdini to record their next album, Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic. Fun fact, Frusciante was somehow convinced the place was haunted and refused to sleep there.
Like, I heard ghosts on the whole record, you know?
You mean in a weird place spiritually?
Yeah, it was just a fun place to be. Uh-huh. Like, I heard ghosts on the whole record, and I'd always say to people when we were playing it for them, we were recording them, I'd say, don't you hear those ghosts? Listen. And Flea would go, John, not everybody hears them. Just we hear them.
Kiedis, on the other end, inside the mansion, found unexpected clarity. He wrote a poem about his struggles with isolation and addiction. Rubin encouraged him to share it with the group, and it evolved into the track Under the Bridge. Kiedis worried the lyrics didn't fit the band's style, but the track became their breakout hit, reaching number two on the Billboard Hot 100.
The hardest of the hard, the gangsters of LA. I'll be riding down the Sunset Boulevard, and I'll hear Under the Bridge coming out of a lowrider, and it is the toughest, scariest, most, you know, loked out looking dudes just melting with Under the Bridge. Mm. I'm like, okay, that was a day well spent in writing that song.
The album climbed to number three on Billboard and went on to sell over 7 million copies in the U.S. Almost overnight, the Chili Peppers were arena headliners. In 1992 and 1993, they toured nonstop, sharing stages with Nirvana and Pearl Jam. Life looked like a dream, but dreams can twist fast, and theirs was about to turn into a nightmare. The success of Blood Sugar Sex Magik transformed the Red Hot Chili Peppers from a niche act into global rock stars. But for John Frusciante, the sudden fame was overwhelming and the pressure cracked him wide open.
Before I quit, we weren't getting along well, you know. It being successful and each of us reacting a different way to it had made us to where we weren't friends anymore, you know.
John felt completely out of place with the band's new level of fame, and the whole band felt it.
I was making everybody feel bad about themselves at that point. I made it because I didn't like the whole, because I wasn't in tune with the whole being a rock star and all that stuff. I made everybody else feel bad about being rock stars, and they had something to be proud of because they'd been working really hard at trying to be a popular band for a long time, and now we were a popular band, and right when they had something to be proud of, I was making them like feel guilty about it or something, mm-hmm. as if there was something evil about it. And there was nothing wrong with being a rock star, it just didn't gel with where I was at inwardly at the time, you know?
By 92, he and Kiedis weren't even talking, not on stage and not on the tour bus. Anthony was pissed and totally fed up with John's somewhat ungrateful attitude towards fame.
And nobody in the band's getting along anymore. Everybody, you know, everybody, like, nobody's having a good time with each other. Mm-hmm. Everybody feels bad about themselves.
Eventually, Frusciante quit giving a damn about the rest of the band. He brought his girlfriend on tour, which went against band rules, and his frustration showed on stage as he messed up tempos on purpose and changed guitar riffs unpredictably.
A huge amount of our success comes from the fact that our live shows, you know, we've built up a real solid, real reputation as one of the finest live bands to be seen by the human eye. And we take a lot of pride in that. And for us to ever go on stage and not be completely, you know, and utterly, you know, and be able to give ourselves up and be totally involved in the music, you know, would be hell for us.
The most infamous incident came on Saturday Night Live in February 1992. While performing Under the Bridge, he butchered it on purpose, slamming dissonant chords and screaming the wrong backing lyrics to deliberately sabotage the performance.
I think he appeared on Saturday Night Live and he was like, ah, 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 like doing like these background vocals, sort of like sounded a little bit like Yoko Ono. You know, he was a drug addict.
It should also be noted that an odd moment happened just before Under the Bridge. As the band finished another track, Anthony Kiedis appeared to kick Frusciante. Whether it was deliberate or accidental, we'll never know, but it added to the tension between the two. The breaking point came in Japan. In May 1992, only a few days into the Blood Sugar Sex Magik World Tour, John told the tour manager he wanted to quit the band.
I remember in Japan, right before I quit, I was saying to my guitar tech, I was like, he's like, you're a great guitar player. And I said, yeah, I used to be a great guitar player. I didn't think I was a great guitar. I thought I had lost everything inside myself.
John Frusciante, due to mental stresses and imbalances and difficulty of dealing with everything, quit the band and left.
And if we would have stayed together at that point, we would have been doing it purely as a business kind of motive, you know, rather than a motive of friendship and wanting to play music together. If we would have done another album with the lineup of me and being in the band, it's what it would have been about, and I didn't want to be a part of anything like that, and I sensed that that sort of thing was happening. You know, there's nothing wrong with a lot of people buying what you do. I never felt that there was a problem with that. I just felt bad about being a part of something where what we were being like acclaimed for was something that I wasn't having fun doing, you know?
His sudden exit forced the band to quickly and perhaps desperately look for a replacement. Their first attempt was guitarist Xander Schloss, but the arrangement didn't work out.
They called me when John quit the band, and after his, like, he was like that, did that notorious Saturday Night Live appearance, and then in Japan he just sort of, I guess, lost it and quit the band. So they said, hey, we want you to come over to Australia and we want you to, you know, play 10 shows with us. It was just after the release of Blood Sugar Sex Magik, and I didn't have anything better to do. So I went over to Australia and I rehearsed with them for a week, and I think, you know, because I would like to, I don't know for sure, but I'd like to set the record straight for myself, that I was able to play all those songs within the time allotted, and I would have gotten up in front of those big massive audiences and kicked some ass. But I think what ended up happening was that they probably felt a little bit bad for soldiering on without John so soon, and it might have come from management, or it may have just been that, you know, it was like I had, like, you know, if we were to do photo shoots, I would have to put on daddy's knee socks, you know what I mean? So that wouldn't have gone well.
In the end, the band canceled the rest of the tour, and this was during the peak of their fame at the time, and went on to audition hundreds of guitarists before finally choosing Jane's Addiction's Dave Navarro.
And so I called him up and said, why don't you come over and play with us? And he came over and played with us for 5 minutes, and then we said, will you join the band? He said yes.
Are you like family now?
Sometimes. I mean, you know, I'm a human, you know, so there are days that I feel in place and days that I don't.
On paper, it looked like a dream hire. Navarro had a lot of talent, charisma, and enough mystique to match the band's growing legend. In practice, though, the chemistry was off. Navarro's darker gothic style, heavy with metal and psychedelia, clashed with the Chili Peppers' wild funk punk energy. His cool dramatic presence never really synced with Kiedis's frantic preacher-like delivery.
Had moments where we fucking crushed it musically and moments where we just didn't line up musically.
Right.
Mainly in the funk area, that was not my space.
Which they were primarily a very funk heavy band.
Especially at the time. Now they're playing more straight up songs, but at the time, heavily, heavily funk influenced. And like, if you think about the spectrum of music as being like a color palette that changes from color to color, we met in the center of it, right? But he went all the way down to the left to the reds. And I went all the way down to the violets, you know what I mean, in terms of our likes. We didn't like the whole rainbow, but we both liked a section of the rainbow.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Make sense? So he was certainly into punk, certainly into punk like I was, but he was into funk bands, he was into Parliament, I was into the punk and all those things. I could generate that kind of attitude, but I was more into the goth bands, which those guys don't want to hear anything about.
The result was One Hot Minute in 1995, a record that sounded nothing like Blood Sugar Sex Magic. Navarro's thick, metallic riffs bulldozed over Flea's elastic bass, and the whole thing tilted toward heavy, brooding rock rather than manic funk. Songs dragged longer, structures got denser, and the playful bounce was buried under distortion. But it is an incredible, almost flawless piece of art nonetheless, arguably their most underrated album to date. At the same time, it's crucial to highlight that at this point, Kiedis was once again fighting heroin relapses, and that struggle percolated into lyrics that were darker, angrier, and more cynical than anything he'd written before.
When we were doing One Hot Minute, I don't think it's any secret that Anthony experimented with drugs in the past. Mm-hmm. He put out a whole book about it.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm not outing him. But during the writing and recording of One Hot Minute, he would go missing for weeks. And he would just go check into a hotel. We wouldn't know where he is.
Which you can relate to, of course.
Which I can completely relate to. And I've done that many times myself. So many times we didn't know if we had a singer. We didn't know if he was alive. We didn't know what we were doing. We were held up for months, very inconvenienced, blah, 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 blah. That's what happens when you're in this business and you work with people on drugs. I've been through it before. I hate to say it, but it's kind of like rock star tax. You know what I mean? Like sometimes you got to wait for the guy to get his shit together to do your thing.
On stage, Navarro looked the part, shirtless, tattooed, oozing rock star swagger from every pore, but the chemistry just wasn't there. Navarro's technical style left little room for the messy, telepathic looseness that defined the band, and so their live shows felt somewhat stiff, and the vibe got heavier and less funky.
We didn't really connect as deeply. We made a record and we worked, but we kept the band going.
And what we discovered is it doesn't matter how great of a musician you get, if the chemistry isn't, you know, sent from God, you might not have the magic.
Yeah.
You know? And we've really come to learn the value of that chemistry, and it's essential to what we do.
The Navarro era lasted just one record and one world tour. And while commercially One Hot Minute performed decently compared to the sales of Blood Sugar Sex Magic, it felt like a letdown. By 1998, the experiment was over and Navarro was out.
Somehow, I just never come off tour. I just never come off tour. I don't unpack. I keep getting high the same. I go live in the Argyle Hotel for a couple months. And got really bad. Then I finally showed up for a Chili Peppers rehearsal, and we had a tour booked, and I honestly couldn't play a fucking note. And Anthony talks about it in his book, where I fell. I mean, I literally tripped into stacks of speakers and storage gear and whatever. Like I fell into a bunch of boxes, basically. And it was like pretty clear that I wasn't going to be able to get it together. And so they decided to go a different direction.
Around the time the band parted ways with Dave Navarro, John Frusciante was working on his own recovery.
There was a very loud voice in my head that said, "You're going to be dead by your birthday." And my birthday would have been 4 months later. And the voice said, "You're going to be dead by your birthday unless you get clean." And so I was pondering this, not sure, because throughout that year that I tried to be clean, it didn't seem like anybody wanted to be my friend. It didn't seem like anybody wanted to really connect with me. It didn't seem like I knew how to interact with people. And so all of a sudden that voice came saying that I was going to die in a few months. And all of a sudden all these things started happening that forced me into a position of having to get clean.
But as the Red Hot Chili Peppers had dismissed Navarro, they were on the brink of breaking up. So Flea suggested a somewhat absurd move. Invite Frusciante back. It was risky, but rehab had worked, and in 1998, the band welcomed him back.
I think other people, you know, saw me as being at a really good place, and before I knew it, they asked me to be in the band again.
His comeback immediately restored the band's creative energy, and together they wrote dozens of new songs.
Yeah. So what is it like getting back together in this constellation with you and on the guitar and with Rick Rubin producing and everything looks?
What's it like?
Yeah, what's it
like? You could hear it on the record. That's what it's like. It's really good. It was a beautiful and unexpected blessing. You know, John coming back made us all feel real good about playing music in this band, and we were kind of reminded of the original spirit that this band was born with, and it's still alive and it still feels good, and there's tons of love and music and everything still in us, and it's kind of like if Ren and Stimpy would have a reunion after not seeing each other for 6 or 7 years.
I think just being around him and seeing how much he pours into what he does is infectious. It's contagious.
With Rick Rubin once again producing, the group released Californication in June 1999. The album blended the Peppers' punk-funk roots with a more melodic, introspective sound, and critics noted its unusually spiritual and melodic tone compared to earlier records. Red Hot Chili Peppers! The world responded in force. The record went multi-platinum super fast, and singles like Scar Tissue, Other Side, and Californication dominated MTV and radio for months. It was a rebirth, but for Kiedis, it was proof that he could finally channel his scars into something people actually wanted to hear. Proof his pain could be a net positive in the world.
I feel like when you get to the metaphorical gates of Peter, really all they're gonna ask you is where you cunt. And I don't know, maybe the whole point of this little tiny blink of an eye that we're here is just to decrease the suffering through kindness and other thoughtful acts. Could be painting, it could be caregiving, you know, it could be just smiling. That's all.
Then came Woodstock 99, a corporate reboot of the 69 festival. Promoters sold it as Peace and Love 2.0, but what they delivered was hell on asphalt.
Looks like an absolute war zone inside here. I can't tell you. There are cars turned over right by the stage. These trucks are just burning, and it looks like military police are just patrolling the whole area. They just told us we have to leave.
200,000 kids cooked alive on an abandoned Air Force base, a giant frying pan with zero shade.
We woke up one morning, there was no...
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
Damn water for like half a day, man. I mean, everybody was bumming. It was hot as hell. And excuse my language, but they were like, no water, man. It was like they're trying to kill us in here. But, you know, and everybody was mad about that.
Food and water cost a fortune. Toilets were overflowing and trash piled everywhere.
There was a lot of frustration about $10 burritos, you know, and $5 hot dogs, things like that. So that's what we were catching when people were coming by. They were throwing bottles at the vendors and, you know, Woodstock, Michael Lang. And so that kind of, you know, did it. And let that shit out of your fucking system.
During Limp Bizkit's Saturday night set, the crowd tore down plywood and fences as Break Stuff played. Organizers blamed Fred Durst, but it was clear the problems were structural. Too many people, not enough care, and way too much greed.
It's crazy. They ruined a good thing.
One guy, crowd surfing, he had a bottle of gin in his hand, and he fell down and he hit a girl in the head, and she cracked the head open, and it took about 30 minutes to get her out of the pit.
By Sunday night, the crowd wasn't feeling peace and love. They were dehydrated, broke, and furious. This was the scene as the Red Hot Chili Peppers took the stage. They were meant to close the festival on a positive note, but the crowd was already in revolt. As if that wasn't enough, promoters made the disastrous call to hand out candles for a vigil against gun violence. And as the Peppers played, the festival literally went up in flames.
One group of people just started going, and it just escalated into another group. They were down there beating on drums. It sounded like a freaking, like a jungle, like a tribe, jumping all over the place, lighting everything on fire.
There was like six fires out there, and one fire truck. I mean, you got 250,000 people out here. You should count on stuff like that, you know? Count on there being fires and stuff. Count for the worst, and they didn't do that.
By the end of it, Kiedis walked off disgusted, realizing he'd been part of a cash grab pretending to be a peace event. Interestingly, in the aftermath, much of the blame for the festival's destruction was placed on Fred Durst.
How scary was it for you up there when they started ripping that place apart and they started taking the plywood off the towers and stuff?
Oh my God. Dude, it's not our fault. That's all I can say.
But I won't go into that here. I've covered it in another video that you can check out later. What's important for the Chili Peppers is that their momentum didn't stop. In 2002, they released By the Way, a record that moved away from raw funk rock toward a more melodic, harmony-driven sound. Frusciante shaped much of its character, layering guitar parts and backing vocals to create a rich, textured feel. Kiedis contributed lyrics focused on themes of sobriety, connection, and love.
So what is the creative process like when you guys make a song? Do they have the music first? Do you have the lyrics first? Is it a combination of the two?
Zero rules. And it happens every which way. And it could be anything. Like, as the Red Hot Chili Peppers don't have it's got to sound like this or it's got to sound like that. It's got to be hard or it's got to be, it could be anything. It could be funky. It could be bluesy. It could be jazzy. It could be hip hop. It could be folk. We'll play anything. Anything that we feel like playing, which is also a blessing because less boxed in.
While some longtime fans missed the band's earlier funk edge, critics and new audiences responded strongly. The album sold millions and solidified the band as established leaders in alternative rock. For Kiedis, these years were pivotal. He had survived his worst addictions, watched his band implode and rebuild, and somehow come out the other side with some of the biggest hits of his career. Rather than slow down, the Chili Peppers pressed forward. In 2006, they released Stadium Arcadium, a double album created in a surprisingly calm and collaborative atmosphere.
Just a lot of variety of different styles of music, and we're real sound much more like a band now than we did on our last album, and it's much more all kinds of dynamics and stuff. You know, it's good music. I'm excited about it.
When the spirit moves you, you try to be there to let it, you know, do what it wants to do. And we got lucky. We got 28 songs, and we liked them, and we put them on the record. Yeah, let the chips fall where they may.
The record debuted at number one globally. Songs like Danny California, Snow Hey Oh, and Tell Me Baby became cultural wallpaper, and the tour packed out arenas and stadiums. But the high didn't last. After the tour, the band took a break, and in 2009, Frusciante quietly left again. This time it wasn't chaos. He simply wanted to pursue electronic music and step away from the grind.
So, ciao.
Ciao.
Having a personal relationship in a band is a hard thing. You've got to be in sync with four people, working as hard as they work, doing, you know, going where they go, doing what they do, almost thinking what they think. It's an intense thing to do, you know, and so I've found for myself that I've needed to clear my head of it and try to figure out who I am as a person.
Josh Klinghoffer, his friend and touring sideman, took his place, but once again, the chemistry wasn't the same. However, this new configuration brought us I'm With You and The Getaway. Both were solid, but without John, the spark dimmed. With him, the Peppers soared. Without him, they coasted. Between those two albums in 2012, the Red Hot Chili Peppers were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. For a band that began as a goof, it was almost surreal. Suited up and honored for 40 years of survival and creativity.
And they talk about being in the right place and the right time. Well, I was in the right place and the right time when I met Flea. He would change my life forever and for the better, and we're still together.
Then in late 2019, lightning struck again as Frusciante rejoined his friends for the third time, and the band came out with Unlimited Love in April 2022, debuting at number one in more than a dozen countries.
What made you ready to come back for this album?
It was a certain amount of soul searching that I'd done. It seemed like I'd changed and grown enough as a person to where it felt like it would be a beautiful thing to have another chance to do it right. I felt that way when I rejoined the first time, on a personal level and on a musical level. I had some new ideas about where I thought those relationships could go, and it was the same thing this time. I was seeing Anthony and Flea and Chad through a different lens than I had seen them through when I quit. I really wanted to have that closeness and that kind of vulnerable interaction with them again.
Just 6 months later, they followed with Return of the Dream Canteen, pulled from the same recording sessions. Proof that even after 40 years, the Red Hot Chili Peppers still had fun playing together. Now in his 60s, Kiedis still stalked the stage shirtless, a bundle of tendons wired on adrenaline. The junkie from the 80s is gone, and so is the moody romantic of the 90s. What's left is unique, a survivor who translated his scars into four decades of melodies.
My most recent revelations is, even though I'm sober, I'm still a flaming addict of anything that presents itself, that goes down those subways of your brain. But I, at the same time, so this, I've got this like powerful addiction personality inside my head, but also the ability to just say, well, that's what I am at this moment in time, and I'm okay with that.
Kiedis is one of the rare rock stars who survived years of brutal heroin abuse, almost died, but ultimately beat addiction. However, along the way, he made some questionable choices, to say the least. His own book describes problematic relationships with teenage girls. Situations that might have slid under the radar back then, but that are wildly inappropriate by today's standards. In 1990, he was also convicted of misdemeanors for indecent exposure stemming from a concert incident. He was fined and later described the event as an overblown prank.
How's it going, Anthony?
In recent years, rumors have swirled that Kiedis is romantically linked with a much younger woman. Thing is, Anthony Kiedis' legacy is not a clean mirror, but a fractured one, mirroring success and relapse, reinvention and regret. He changed the template for rock frontmen, blending rap, funk, punk, melody, and street confidence into a singular voice. And he's also a damn proud dad. In 2007, he and model Heather Christie welcomed a son, Everly Bear Kiedis.
Wow, I'm late to the club. Josh is yet to join the club. These guys have been at it for a good long time, and it seems to have served them very well.
But you have a girl?
A little boy.
A boy?
Who's often mistaken for a girl because his hair is real long.
And he's wearing an awesome Grinder Man shirt today.
And how old is he?
He's coming up on 4.
You've been at it for plenty long.
Okay.
Plenty long. You're fully in the club.
Oh, I'm in the club. But I love the club.
But how do you... Yeah.
Good God, it's a beautiful club. Yeah. Who knew?
Yeah.
You can't know.
Yeah.
Until you go.
Yeah.
It's wild.
He survived what should have killed him, wrote anthems that bent genres, and kept the Chili Peppers alive through death, relapse, and riots.
I don't like the idea of stopping or retiring. I think that that's kind of foolish for me. I'd rather just keep working until I can't. I like working, and I like working with these guys, and I feel like I have a lot more to say, and I'm compelled to try to write good music. I want to know what that feels like again to write another good song. So no interest in benchmarking out at this point. You know, the future may have a different idea for me, but for the moment, it's just to keep on playing music.
In the end, Anthony Kiedis' story shows that even the most chaotic and messy lives can be reshaped into creativity that makes the world move, dance, and feel joy.